Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. American society has set store by the notion of family since the earliest days of the Republic. But the conception of family has been quite mutable, as the country has grown more complex in its makeup and its citizens more varied in their ancestry and condition. A very special perspective on American ideas about the family is provided by the phenomenon of adoption. The history of adoption is itself an account of changing American attitudes about who belongs together and why. My guest is Barbara Meloche, professor of English and History at George Mason University. Barbara, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks.
This is a fascinating topic, and it's one that's very real for so many of us. Indeed, I think many listening as well as those of us who are privileged to sit here and talk about it. Barbara, I think one way we might approach the history of adoption is to look at what preceded it in terms of not just this society, but perhaps many Western societies. And I have in mind the idea of apprenticeship, which was the way in which custody of children was who were orphaned or relinquished was given over to adults in the past. First of all, is that correct? And if so, what precisely was apprenticeship?
Well, I think apprenticeship was a very important way of dealing with children who were not with their biological parents through most of the 18th and 19th century in the United States. And what it was placing a child with a substitute family that basically functioned as employers and a way to train children in some kind of work to get them launched into what would be their adult role in society. And these relationships did involve a certain kind of stewardship that the employer was supposed to, you know, take care of the child, nurture its prospects in life. But it wasn't understood to be a parental relationship. It was kind of a limited commitment. And it was oriented around work. So it was certainly not something that would be chosen for an infant or young child.
What begins to change that state of affairs in our country?
Well, I think by the early 20th century, there's really a new view of the child. I mean, childhood is understood as a distinctive part of life. Children's economic value declines, but their emotional stock escalates and rises. Mm-hmm. And there's then a new value seen on infants and small children as well. They're no longer seen as just kind of useless drains on the on the family, but as valuable in themselves.
Is there any connection with that sort of emerging sense of children with the kinds of reform movements that were underway in the late 19th century?
I think very much so. And the immediate and direct predecessor is the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
Oh.
This gets started out. And then after a few years, people think, whoa, what about children? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that the first sensibility is attached to, you know, how animals are treated. And then there's an understanding that maybe we should look at the young of our own species in the same way.
Well, you know, that progression is interesting because it would suggest that there was awareness, however embryonic, with questions of abuse of the children in the apprenticeship relationship, that they were being ill-treated.
Yes, that's right. There was a concern that they, you know, having the cash nexus be, you know, quite so much at the center, or the question of children's economic utility was not the right question to ask in dealing with dependent children.
Mm-hmm. When I hear this from you, Barbara, it makes me think, and I suppose this is the question, is that adoption, at least as we've come to think of it, is a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, as a legal condition, other separate from apprenticeship, it doesn't seem to be all that old.
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the things I find fascinating about this history, that it is pretty short. The first adoption laws were passed in the mid-19th century. But for most of the 19th century, adoption was a relationship that was more about straightening out inheritance. Mm. In some states, you couldn't adopt a minor child. It was just something between adults, and it was about who could inherit what. But then in the early 20th century, there's a new understanding of adoption as a way to form a family, a substitute family that could be the equivalent of a biological family. And the adoption laws of the 19-teens on reflect that understanding.
What it seems to be occurring is that as the society moves to a notion of adoption, it must have begun to think about the very nature of family. I mean, family is a biological unit as opposed to something that's sort of environmentally constituted. Is that kind of the sort of shift we get in the focus on this question?
Yes, I think that's right. And in the early 20th century, you have the sort of unusual situation of a number of adults who are don't have children and are very actively seeking to adopt, who are confronting child welfare workers who are the stewards of large numbers of dependent children, but who really doubt that adoption is going to be the way to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. This is intriguing in and of itself. I mean, you introduce the social worker in your answer, and that becomes, as a profession, extremely important to this issue, as we'll see. But I do have the impression that from the start, again, as you've said, they themselves were not all that enthusiastic about adoption as the answer to this issue.
No, they just didn't think it would work. And there's this interesting transition in this period where child welfare workers are very concerned about orphanages. The 19th century enthusiasm for all kinds of institutions is drastically declining by then, and people want to get rid of orphanages. They think this is not the way to take care of dependent children. But they just don't believe that people would be willing to raise a child not their own, those mm-hmm. loaded words. And so they think the solution is what they call child placing, which is what we would call foster care.
Homes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, there were these increasing numbers of adults who used the phrase, we want to raise a child as our own.
That's fascinating right there. It's what I call a kind of a sentimental justification that seemed to be growing in the society at large. I mean, sort of an attitudinal shift in society beyond the professionals immediately connected with the question.
Yes, I think that's right, that these adults really saw themselves as not to be denied as parents. They were not going to accept the sentence of infertility, and they were then open to raising children not born to them as their own.
But, you know, to speak of the social workers involved in all of this, I got the impression, Barbara, that their sort of, I wouldn't say sovereignty over the question, but their place in the whole question of adoption was always conflicted and challenged by other sectors of society. I mean, I got the impression that the social worker, the legal community, the medical community, even the theological community were all sort of vying for portions of control of the question of adoption as it became more popular in American society.
Yes, it really is a contested ground. And I think often it's been portrayed in retrospect in some other way as a history of social control with the social workers calling all the shots. But it really wasn't that way. I mean, social workers even today have limited legal mandate to control adoption. And all along it was there was conflicting views of adoption among different professionals mm-hmm. and lay people also.
Mm-hmm. I want to move us into what's going on today, but I'm also fascinated with the basis, the history of how we got to where we are. And one aspect of it I'd love to ask you about right now, and that's the role of agencies, particularly something called the Federal Children's Bureau. When did this become, what was it, and when did it become a factor in what we're talking about?
Right. Well, the Children's Bureau was very important as an agency of the federal government. Founded in that progressive era in 1912 by mainly female reformers. And the Children's Bureau had, by law, had no legislative or policy role, but it was a very influential advisory agency. And it did take a major role in adoption. And how it operated really was to create this very powerful network. The federal agency reached out to state and voluntary agencies across the country. The records there are kind of a cross-section of what's happening across the whole country. And they did provide a kind of clearinghouse. They provided really the place where social workers and other child welfare professionals began to define what they thought the standards should be. And they mm-hmm. also had an effect on legislation, mm-hmm. which is interesting, too, because they weren't supposed to be lobbying.
Right.
But putting out model legislation was understood to be something a little bit different, and they did mm-hmm. do that.
Did they inspire counterpart organizations at the state level? And the existence of the Federal Children's Bureau.
Well, there were agencies that were called the Children's Bureau in other states, and it can be kind of confusing because you'd think then that these were state affiliates. they were not. The Federal Children's Bureau had no state affiliates. It did not act as a placement agency. But I think it does suggest the sense of affiliation that these state organizations felt, that they were calling themselves the same name as the federal agency.
Clarify something for me, Barbara. It just occurred to me. At this period, progressive as it was, the teens and the 20s, could adoption be variously accomplished, that is to say, by formal agencies outside and also outside the province of agencies, by individuals? I mean, were there a variety of ways to accomplish the purpose of adopting a child?
Oh, very much so. In fact, there was no state in the country where it was law that you had to go through a social work agency, much to the consternation of social workers. They wanted that kind of law. Right. They wanted the social mandate that they had to be the mediators of adoption. But that was not the case at all. So agency adoption was, in effect, competing with lots of other forms of adoption. Sometimes a mother who realized or felt that she couldn't care for her child did the placement herself, found a sister, a neighbor, another relative who would raise her child. Sometimes others acted as intermediaries, lawyers. Very often doctors and nurses, a sympathetic physician who is caring for infertile patients would at the same time have in his or her practice a young woman who was unhappily pregnant and make the match. So most adoptions were accomplished that way rather than through agencies.
You know, I almost don't know how to phrase this question, but it just fascinates me. And it once again just occurred to me, because at the other side of this spectrum of adoption, that is to say, the young mothers who were providing these children, there must have been an extraordinary social drama underway as well. I mean, the way they were viewed by society, the institutions that were housing them, or the kinds of pressures on them to relinquish their children for adoption. Was all of that also undergoing great change in the early teens and 20s?
Yes, very much so. And in the teens and 20s, the agencies, the religious organizations primarily that did reach out to assist, you know, women who were pregnant, usually out of wedlock, it didn't at all have the expectation that adoption would be the outcome. They expected that these young women would raise their children themselves, and they believed that they should. They thought that this way the sinner could be redeemed.
And this was also a preference of the biological link as opposed to a different kind of link?
Yes. I think it was also driven by the belief that other child welfare workers shared that there was no other outcome for the child, so that it was important that the biological mother assume responsibility. But they thought it was important for the mother's spiritual health, too, that she be the one to raise the child. And adoption was then somewhat suspect, that here was a way to get out of your mistake, to escape your sin. And, you know, that was not to be countenanced. So most of these early maternity homes required that the mother stay with her infant for at least 3 months, breastfeed and take care of the infant and so on.
As a form of penance.
Right.
Barbara, with that answer, you've moved us very nicely into the 30s, and I want to talk about what happens to adoption as a phenomenon in that decade. Before I do that, though, let me take a moment to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Barbara Melosh, professor of English and History at George Mason University and a current fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. The 1930s. What's different now? I mean, we've gone to the teens and 20s where, as you've explained, so much was being set in place. Are things, that is to say, laws concerning adoption more codified in the 30s, and has the role of the social worker changed as a result of that?
Well, in the 30s and 40s, social workers come to be less suspicious of adoption. They take it on and they want to take it over. So they have more of a sense themselves of what good casework is, and they are trying to win public support for this, including legislation. And there's lots of adoption-related laws begin to be passed, things about, you know, clarifying what it means to relinquish parental rights legally, establishing what kinds of placement procedures should take place. But no state requires social work intervention in adoption until the 50s. So it's still pretty unregulated. But social workers themselves have a clearer sense of what good casework is, and they're trying to do it. And their idea is to make a good match, to assess the family and the child, and try to see that the two are well suited.
This is a question that's going to repeat itself in our conversation, but this might be the one of the first points to ask it. As the things get sort of established in this way, with the more codified practices, the roles more defined, and the requests for adoption ever greater, are American notions of the family beginning to change? Is there an increasing acceptance of adoption as a sort of a viable way of making a family?
I think you do begin to see, what comes into full bloom after World War II, a kind of a racial and ethnic universalism, a sense that Americans are interchangeable, that the boundaries of family can be a little bit more fluid. And there certainly is more openness to the idea that an outsider can become one of the family.
Well, then that is the case, and I think that's well said. Then it would seem that, say, from the 1950s up to maybe the early 70s is the apogee of this. Is that correct to think of that?
Yes, that's right. That really is the high point of adoption, and you see a very clear white middle-class consensus around adoption, that it is a good idea, and not only a good idea, but it's the best solution is the word that's used, the phrase that's used for children born out of wedlock and their mothers.
What about other factors that might have influenced that? I mean, I'm mindful that those were, of course, the post-war years. I mean, the availability of children, I mean, displaced children, for example, would seem to have been much greater, and the international aspects of adoption much more readily at hand. Does that also influence the kind of universalistic notion that this is a way of building family and community?
I think lots of historians have seen the 40s as a real turning point, and that's certainly true for the people that I'm looking at, that that there is a sense then that of optimism, a sense of possibility. I think adoption is also fueled in this period by a real optimism about upward mobility. You know, the economy is expanding. Everybody has a chance at the prize in this period, and that I think makes people more open to the possibility of adoption, improving the prospects of these children born out of wedlock, and also not condemning women who've made a mistake to lifelong penance.
I may say so. That sounds ideal. I almost want to go back to the period, but it does. Things do change, of course, as they always do in life. And what changes this picture? I mean, what constrains it, and what brings it to an end, so to speak, essentially?
Well, I think there were always some tensions in the whole proposition that adoption was the best solution, but those are overridden, in that period between about 1945 and 1970, when there is so much confidence in adoption. But lots of things happened to change that picture around 1970, and one is the availability of legal abortion, which really changes the whole experience and perception of pregnancy out of wedlock. There's also a growing tolerance for children raised in different kinds of families that puts a different cast on adoption.
Of course, I also associate the early 70s with rising tides of ethnic nationalism and that kind of thing. Did that have an effect on the question of adoption?
A very direct one. There's a very dramatic critique of the kinds of racial universalism that had been so important in the 40s and in the early 50s, the early phases of the civil rights movement as well. And there's a new sense from the black community of claiming African Americans as a community, including claiming the children of that community.
The argument that only African Americans can adopt African American children, is that the notion?
That's right. That's right. And the Black Social Workers Association then issued a historic and very influential position paper saying African American children should be placed only within that community, only as a last resort placed out of it.
These seem to be still questions that we're dealing with today. I mean, for example, I you're absolutely right that that's when this becomes a major factor. But as we look around today, or at least this is very impressionistic on my part, I'm impressed with the numbers of families that are once again constituting themselves on other than racial lines. I mean, where you see a variety of ethnic backgrounds in the same family via adoption. So that's once again a phenomenon, is it?
Yeah, it's a complicated situation today because certainly we see you know, very fluid kinds of boundaries around families. And one is that you do see lots of transracial and transnational families, especially around Washington.
Exactly.
But and you see families that are untraditional in other ways, too. I have friends who are lesbian and have just completed cross adoptions of their children born to each of them by artificial insemination. So there's a broadness in our view of adoption on the one hand today. But on the other hand, there's been a very dramatic drop in the numbers of adoption since 1970. And I think that tells us something about the constricted boundaries.
Right. Well, let's separate the two phenomena just for a moment. This these differently constituted families, transracial families that we've just talked about, families in which the parents are non-traditional, lesbian families, et cetera, even if the number of adoptions overall is lesser, does the very existence of these kinds of adoptions, does that also, and I return to the earlier question, make a comment about how we are evolving notions of what family is in American society?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, declining numbers in a way, you know, can be hard to interpret because is that a good thing or a bad thing? And I would say it would be a wonderful thing if it meant that all the world's children and all our country's children are well cared for, that their mothers are not desperately hard-pressed and so on. Unfortunately, I don't think that that is the case. And so my question is, why has adoption become less visible or less approved as a solution or a response to the needs of dependent children? And the fact that there are a very broadening, that the family has broadened, that there's different kinds of adoptive families, I think certainly shows us that that's still possible, obviously, since it's happening. But I also think it shows us that the adoptions that are taking place are only among exceptional people who are the most interventionist, the most willing to persist and break the rules, and who have more resources to be able to do it. So I think adoption is not available as widely as it used to be. It's much harder these days for working class families to adopt. Even looking at international adoptions, to adopt in China, you have to be able at any moment to leave your job for 3 months. Not everybody can do that.
That's right. As a matter of fact, you remind me of the accounts I read of, and friends I have, who have adopted children in China, in Latin America, Russia, and elsewhere. And it is an extremely intricate and involved and demanding process, absolutely. One aspect of the adoption picture, to use a word, in America that I must say fascinates me, it may be tangential to the question of adoption, but it's it seems to be increasingly mentioned, and that is the numbers of people, adopted people, in their adult years who are making an effort to locate their biological parents. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think search and reunion is such an interesting indicator of the changes that have happened in adoption. And on one hand, it's very clearly and self-consciously a repudiation of the idea of the best solution, that the adoptive family is permanent and that the legal relinquishment severs all ties with the biological family. And we are hearing from adopted persons and from many women who relinquish children for adoption that this is not true. This is not their lived experience. This is not their emotional experience of adoption. And this movement began years ago, but the first people to say this were dismissed as crackpots. Their work was not accepted by mainstream presses. It was privately published, privately circulated, and so on. But after 1970, these accounts get a new audience, and there's much more sympathy for search and reunion.
Has there been any assessment, formally or informally, by those who've undertaken these searches as to what the benefit or detriment of having done it was?
Well, there's lots of testimony on that, which I'm very interested in, and reading published accounts of this, and then more informal ones that circulate. And there's been a couple of studies. I mean, the formal studies mostly show that most people who are searched are glad they did so, although the outcomes are sometimes not what they had hoped or expected, that often after initial period of kind of intense relationship, things trail off a little. And people do have a sense of being on very difficult ground. It's often expressed by a sense of both familiarity and estrangement. she was my mother, she was a stranger.
Right.
And both things are true. Mm. So then how do you make a relationship out of that? Mm-hmm. But it is striking that most searchers do express satisfaction with just, you know, getting more knowledge.
You know, one of the things and one of the reasons that I find the subject absolutely fascinating, Barbara, is that it's such a mirror of the history of the society at large. I mean, it both, you know, sort of reflects and refracts and also influences it. And I'm wondering that in what we're talking about at this moment, the searching for the biological parents, is that in turn, at least to some degree, a reflection of society's sort of more general interest in genealogy, which seems to have been a factor in the last couple of decades? I mean, you seem to have, among Americans broadly defined, this increasing interest in who their ancestors were.
I think that's exactly right. And roots is a big influence, a very direct one, and that's sometimes invoked mm-hmm. in search and reunion narratives. And I think search and reunion also has a broader interest because many Americans perceive the family to be embattled and fragmented. Many of us feel we don't know who our family is, or we don't have secure ties to kin. So this mm-hmm. this idea of finding new parents, mm-hmm. I think, can be a very appealing one.
Well, your eloquence throughout this conversation, Barbara, has been remarkable. And with that answer, you've actually given me the key to my concluding question, which is this. The book that you're writing and the scholarship and the personal interest you devote to this all suggest that you have a very profound interest in this question of how we compose families and how we can affect patterns of kinship among strangers, that is to say, people who are not directly related. And it may be awfully premature to ask you this, but I can't resist it. And that is, as you've studied the historical evolution of adoption to this point and whatever you may be able to foresee, how do you feel about that question of, particularly in this society, which is what it is, complex and grand and varied, the idea of growing kinship between strangers through phenomena like adoption? Are you hopeful or how do you feel about it?
Well, it's hard to say which way things are going to go, and historians are usually reluctant to predict. But I do think that adoption, one of the things that draws me about adoption is that it's a bold experiment in widening the circle of we, of trying to understand, you know, who we are to each other in a way that goes beyond boundaries of blood kinship.
Well, that's an excellent answer indeed, as all the answers have been. So thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue.
Well, thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Barbara Milosh, professor of English and History at George Mason University. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at www.ics.si.edu.